faces had suddenly gone almost as pale as their lab smocks. "Sure," he said softly. "Which of you wants to go get the little girl?" No one moved. It was amusing, really. It occurred to Rainbird that this was the way the politicians were going to look when they found out it was finally done. That the missiles were really in the air, the bombs raining down, the woods and cities on fire. It was so amusing he had to laugh. And laugh. And laugh. 17. "They're so beautiful," Charlie said softly. "It's all so beautiful." They were standing near the duck pond, not far from where her father and Pinchot had stood only a few days previously. This day was much cooler than that one had been, and a few leaves had begun to show color. A light wind, just a little too stiff to be called a breeze, ruffled the surface of the pond. Charlie turned her face up to the sun and closed her eyes, smiling. John Rainbird, standing beside her, had spent 6 months on stockade duty at Camp Stewart in Arizona before going overseas, and he had seen the same expression on the faces of men coming out after a long, hard bang inside. "Would you like to walk over to the stables and look at the horses?"
"Oh, yes, sure,"
she said immediately, and then glanced shyly at him.
"That is, if you don't mind."
"Mind? I'm glad to be outside, too. This is recess for me."
"Did they assign you?"
"Nah," he said. They began to walk along the edge of the pond toward the stables on the far side. "They asked for volunteers. I don't think they got many, after what happened yesterday."
"It scared them?"
Charlie asked, just a little too sweetly. "I guess it did," Rainbird said. And he was speaking nothing but the truth. Cap had caught up with Charlie as she wandered down the hall and escorted her back to her apartment. The young man who had bolted his position at the EEG was now being processed for duty in Panama City. The staff meeting following the test had been a nutty affair, with the scientists at both their best and worst, blue-skying 100 new ideas on one hand, and worrying tiresomely, and considerably after the fact, about how to control her on the other hand. It was suggested that her quarters be fireproofed, that a full-time guard be installed, that the drug series be started on her again. Rainbird had listened to as much of this as he could bear and then rapped hard on the edge of the conference table with a band of the heavy turquoise ring he wore. He rapped until he had the attention of everyone there. Because Hochstetter disliked him, and perhaps hated would not have been too strong a word, his cadre of scientists also disliked him. But Rainbird's star had risen in spite of that. He had, after all, been spending a good part of each day with this human blowtorch. "I suggest," he had said, rising to his feet and glaring around at them benignly from the shattered lens of his face, "that we continue exactly as we have been. Up until today, you have been proceeding on the premise that the girl probably didn't have the ability which you all knew had been documented 24 times over, and that if she did have it, it was a small ability. And if it wasn't a small ability, she would probably never use it again anyway. Now you know differently, and you'd like to upset her all over again."
"That's not true," Hochstetter said, annoyed. "That is simply..."
"It is true," Rainbird thundered at him, and Hochstetter shrank back in his chair. Rainbird smiled again at the faces around the table. "Now, the girl is eating again. She has put on 10 pounds. It is no longer a scrawny shadow of what she should be. She is reading, talking, doing paint-by-the-numbers kits. She has asked for a dollhouse, which her friend the orderly has promised to try and get for her. In short, her frame of mind is better than it has been since she came here. Gentlemen, we are not going to start monkeying around with the fruitful status quo, are we?" The man who had been monitoring the videotape equipment earlier had said hesitantly, "But what if she sets that little suite of hers on fire?"
"If she was going to," Rainbird said quietly, "she would have done it already."
To that there had been no response. Now, as he and Charlie left the edge of the pond and crossed toward the dark red stables with their fresh piping of white paint, Rainbird laughed out loud.
"I guess you did scare them, Charlie."
"But you're not scared?"
Why should I be scared? Rainbird said and ruffled her hair. I only turn into a baby when it's dark and I can't get out.
Oh, John, you don't have to be ashamed of that.
If you were going to light me up, he said, rephrasing his comment of the night before, I guess you would have by now. She stiffened immediately.
I wish you wouldn't even say things like that.
Charlie, I'm sorry. Sometimes my mouth gets ahead of my brains. They went into the stables, which were dim and fragrant. Dusky sunlight slanted in, making mellow bars and stripes in which motes of hay chaff danced with dreamy slowness. A groom was currying the mane of a black gelding with a white blaze on its forehead. Charlie stopped, looking at the horse with delighted wonder. The groom looked around at her and grinned.
You must be the young miss. They told me to be on the watch out for you.
She's so beautiful, Charlie whispered. Her hands trembled to touch that silky coat. One look in the horse's dark, calm, mellow eyes, and she was in love.
Well, it's a boy, actually, the groom said, and tipped a wink at Rainbird, whom he had never seen before and didn't know from Adam. After a fashion, that is.
What's his name?
Necromancer, the groom said. Want to pet him?
Charlie drew hesitantly near. The horse lowered his head, and she stroked him. After a few moments, she spoke to him. It did not occur to her that she would light another half-dozen fires just to ride on him with John beside her. But Rainbird saw it in her eyes, and he smiled. She looked around at him suddenly and saw the smile, and for a moment, the hand she had been stroking the horse's muzzle with paused. There was something in that smile she didn't like, and she had thought she liked everything about John. She got feelings about most people and did not consider this much. It was part of her, like her blue eyes and her double-jointed thumb. She usually dealt with people on the basis of these feelings. She didn't like Hochstetter, because she felt that he didn't care for her any more than he would care for a test tube. She was just an object to him. But with John, her liking was based only on what he did, his kindness to her, and perhaps part of it was his disfigured face. She could identify and sympathize with him on that account. After all, why was she here if not because she was also a freak? Yet beyond that, he was one of those rare people, like Mr. Roucher, the delicatessen owner in New York who often played chess with her daddy, who were, for some reason, completely closed to her. Mr. Roucher was old and wore a hearing aid and had a faded blue number tattooed on his forearm. Once Charlie had asked her father if that blue number meant anything, and her daddy had told her, after cautioning her never to mention it to Mr. Roucher, that he would explain it later. But he never had. Sometimes Mr. Roucher would bring her slices of kielbasa, which she would eat while watching TV. And now, looking at John's smile, which seemed so strange and somehow disquieting, she wondered for the first time, "What are you thinking?" Then such trifling thoughts were swept away by the wonder of the horse.
"John," she said, "what does necromancer mean?"
"Well," he said, "so far as I know, it means something like wizard or sorcerer."
Wizard. Sorcerer.
She spoke the words softly, tasting them as she stroked the dark silk of Necromancer's muzzle. 18. Walking back with her, Rainbird said,
"You ought to ask that Hochstetter to let you ride that horse if you like him so much." "No, I couldn't,"
she said, looking at him wide-eyed and startled.
"Oh, sure you could," he said, purposely misunderstanding.
"I don't know much about geldings, but I know they're supposed to be gentle. He looks awful big, but I don't think he'd run away with you, Charlie."
"No, I don't mean that. They just wouldn't let me."
He stopped her by putting his hands on her shoulders. "Charlie McGee, sometimes you're really dumb," he said. "You done me a good turn that time the lights went out, Charlie, and you kept it to yourself. So now you listen to me, and I'll do you one. You want to see your father again?" She nodded quickly. "Then you want to show them that you mean business. It's like poker, Charlie. If you ain't dealing from strength, why,
You just ain't dealing. Every time you light a fire for them, for one of their tests, you get something from them.
He gave her shoulders a soft shake.
This is your Uncle John talking to you. Do you hear what I'm saying?
Do you really think they'd let me, if I asked?
If you asked, maybe not. But if you told them, yeah.
I hear them sometimes.
You go in to empty their waste baskets and ashtrays. They think you're just another piece of the furniture.
That Hochstetter's just about wetting his pants.
Really?
She smiled a little.
Really?
They began to walk again.
What about you, Charlie?
I know how scared of it you were before. How do you feel about it now?
She was a long time answering, and when she did, it was in a more thoughtful and somehow adult tone than Rainbird had ever heard from her.
It's different now, she said.
It's a lot stronger. But I was more in control of it than I ever was before. That day at the farm...
She shivered a little and her voice dropped a little.
It just got away for a little while. It went everywhere.
Her eyes darkened.
She looked inside memory and saw chickens exploding like horrible living fireworks. But yesterday, when I told it to back off, it did. I said to myself, it's just going to be a small fire. And it was. It was like I let it out in a single straight line.
And then you pulled it back into yourself?
God, no, she said, looking at him. I put it into the water. If I pulled it back into myself, I guess I'd burn up.
They walked in silence for a while.
Next time there has to be more water.
But you're not scared now?
Not as scared as I was, she said, making the careful distinction. When do you think they'll let me see my dad?
He put an arm around her shoulders in rough, good comradeship.
Give them enough rope, Charlie, he said.
19. It began to cloud up that afternoon, and by evening a cold autumn rain had begun to fall. In one house of a small and very exclusive suburb near the shop complex, a suburb called Longmont Hills, Patrick Hochstetter was in his workshop, building a model boat. The boats and his restored T-Bird were his only hobbies, and there were dozens of his whalers and frigates and packets about the house. And thinking about Charlie McGee, he was in an extremely good mood. He felt that if they could get another dozen tests out of her, even another 10, his future would be assured. He could spend the rest of his life investigating the properties of Lot 6, and at a substantial raise in pay. He carefully glued a mizzenmast in place and began to whistle. In another house in Longmont Hills, Herman Pinchett was pulling a pair of his wife's panties over a gigantic erection. His eyes were dark and trance-like. His wife was at a Tupperware party. One of his two fine children was at a Cub Scout meeting, and the other fine child was at an intramural chess tourney at the junior high school. Pinchett carefully hooked one of his wife's bras behind his back. It hung limply on his narrow chest. He looked at himself in the mirror and thought he looked, well, very pretty. He walked out into the kitchen, heedless of the unshaded windows. He walked like a man in a dream. He stood by the sink and looked down into the maw of the newly installed Waste King disposer. After a long, thoughtful time, he turned it on. And to the sound of its whirling, gnashing steel teeth, he took himself in hand and masturbated. When his orgasm had come and gone, he started and looked around. His eyes were full of blank terror, the eyes of a man waking from a nightmare. He shut off the garbage disposal and ran for the bedroom, crouching low as he passed the windows. His head ached and buzzed. What in the name of God was happening to him? In yet a third Longmont Hills house, a house with a hillside view that the likes of Hochstetter and Pinchett could not hope to afford, Cap Hollister and John Rainbird sat drinking brandy from snifters in the living room. Vivaldi issued from Cap's stereo system. Vivaldi had been one of his wife's favorites. Poor Georgia.
I agree with you, Cap said slowly, wondering again why he had invited this man whom he hated and feared into his home.
The girl's power was extraordinary, and he supposed extraordinary power made for strange bedfellows. The fact that she mentioned a next time in such an offhand way is extremely significant.
Yes, Rainbird said. It appears we do indeed have a string to play out.
But it won't last forever. Cap swirled his brandy, then forced himself to meet Rainbird's one glittering eye.
I believe I understand how you intend to lengthen that string, even if Hochstetter does not.
Do you?
Yes, Cap said, paused a moment, then added, It's dangerous to you.
Rainbird smiled.
If she finds out what side you're really on, Cap said, you stand a good chance of finding out what a steak feels like in a microwave oven.
Rainbird's smile lengthened into an unfunny shark's grin.
And would you shed a bitter tear, Captain Hollister?
No, Cap said. No sense lying to you about that. But for some time now, since before she actually went and did it, I felt the ghost of Dr. Wanless drifting around in here, sometimes as close as my own shoulder.
He looked at Rainbird over the rim of his glass.
Do you believe in ghosts, Rainbird?
Yes, I do.
Then you know what I mean. During the last meeting I had with him, he tried to warn me. He made a metaphor. Let me see. John Milton at 7, struggling to write his name in letters that were legible. And that same human being growing up to write Paradise Lost. He talked about her potential for destruction.
Yes, Rainbird said, and his eye gleamed.
He asked me what we'd do if we found we had a little girl who could progress from starting fires to causing nuclear explosions to cracking the very planet open. I thought he was funny, irritating, and almost certainly mad.
But now you think he may have been right.
Let us say that I find myself wondering sometimes at 3 a.m, don't you?
Cap, when the Manhattan Project group exploded their first atomic device, no one was quite sure what would happen. There was a school of thought which felt that the chain reaction would never end, that we would have a miniature sun glowing in the desert out there, even unto the end of the world.
Cap nodded slowly.
The Nazis were also horrible, Rainbird said. The Japs were horrible. Now the Germans and the Japanese are nice, and the Russians are horrible. The Muslims are horrible. Who knows who may become horrible in the future?
She's dangerous, Cap said, rising restlessly. Wanless was right about that. She's a dead end.
Maybe.
Hochstetter says that the place where that tray hit the wall was rippled. It was sheet steel, but it rippled with the heat. The tray itself was twisted entirely out of shape. She smelted it. That little girl might have put out 3,000 degrees of heat for a split second there.
He looked at Rainbird, but Rainbird was looking vaguely around the living room, as if he had lost interest.
What I'm saying is that what you plan to do is dangerous for all of us, not just for you.
Oh, yes, Rainbird agreed complacently. There's a risk. Maybe we won't have to do it. Maybe Hochstetter will have what he needs before it becomes necessary to implement, Plan B.
Hochstetter's a type, Cap said curtly. He's an information junkie. He'll never have enough. He could test her for 2 years and still scream we were too hasty when we took her away. You know it and I know it, so let's not play games.
We'll know when it's time, Rainbird said.
I'll know.
And then what will happen?
John the friendly orderly will come in, Rainbird said, smiling a little. He will greet her and talk to her and make her smile. John the friendly orderly will make her feel happy, because he's the only one who can. And when John feels she is at the moment of greatest happiness, he will strike her across the bridge of the nose, breaking it explosively, and driving bone fragments into her brain. It will be quick, and I will be looking into her face when it happens.
He smiled, nothing shark-like about it this time. The smile was gentle, kind, and fatherly.
Cap drained his brandy. He needed it. He only hoped that Rainbird would indeed know the right time when it came, or they might all find out what a steak felt like in a microwave oven.
"You're crazy," Cap said.
The words escaped before he could hold them back, but Rainbird did not seem offended.
"Oh, yes," he agreed, and drained his own brandy. He went on smiling.
20. Big Brother. Big Brother was the problem. Andy moved from the living room of his apartment to the kitchen, forcing himself to walk slowly, to hold a slight smile on his face, the walk and expression of a man who was pleasantly stoned out of his gourd. So far, he had succeeded only in keeping himself here, near Charlie, and finding out that the nearest road was Highway 301, and that the countryside was fairly rural. Although that had been a week ago, it had been a month since the blackout, and he still knew nothing more about the layout of this installation than he had been able to observe when he and Pinchot went for their walks. He didn't want to push anyone down here in his quarters, because Big Brother was always watching and listening. And he didn't want to push Pinchot anymore, because Pinchot was cracking up, and he was sure of it. Since their little walk by the duck pond, Pinchot had lost weight. There were dark circles under his eyes, as if he were sleeping poorly. He sometimes would begin speaking and then trail off, as if he had lost his train of thought, or as if it had been interrupted, all of which made Andy's own position that much more precarious. How long before Pinchot's colleagues noticed what was happening to him? They might think it nothing but nervous strain, but suppose they connected it with him. That would be the end of whatever slim chance Andy had of getting out of here with Charlie. And his feeling that Charlie was in big trouble had got stronger and stronger. What in the name of Jesus Christ was he going to do about Big Brother? He got a Welch's grape from the fridge, went back to the living room, and sat down in front of the TV without seeing it, his mind working restlessly, looking for some way out. But when that way out came, it was, like the power blackout, a complete surprise. In a way, it was Herman Pinchot who opened the door for him. He did it by killing himself. 21. Two men came and got him. He recognized one of them from Mander's farm.
"Come on, big boy," this one said. "Little walk."
Andy smiled foolishly, but inside the terror had begun. Something had happened. Something bad had happened. They didn't send guys like this if it was something good. Perhaps he had been found out. In fact, that was the most likely thing.
"Where to?"
"Just come on." He was taken to the elevator, but when they got off in the ballroom, they went farther into the house instead of outside. They passed the secretarial pool, entered a smaller room where a secretary ran off correspondence on an IBM typewriter.
"Go right in," she said.
They passed her on the right and went through a door into a small study with a bay window that gave a view of the duck pond through a screen of low alders. Behind an old-fashioned roll-top desk sat an elderly man with a sharp, intelligent face. His cheeks were ruddy, but from sun and wind rather than liquor, Andy thought. He looked up at Andy, then nodded at the two men who had brought him in.
"Thank you. You can wait outside."
They left. The man behind the desk looked keenly at Andy, who looked back blandly, still smiling a bit. He hoped to God he wasn't overdoing it.
"Hello. Who are you?" he asked.
"My name is Captain Hollister, Andy. You can call me Cap. They tell me I'm in charge of this here rodeo."
"Pleased to meet you," Andy said. He let his smile widen a little. Inside, the tension screwed itself up another notch.
"I've some sad news for you, Andy."
"Oh, God, no. It's Charlie. Something's happened to Charlie."
Cap was watching him steadily with those small, shrewd eyes. Eyes caught so deeply in their pleasant nets of small wrinkles that you almost didn't notice how cold and studious they were.
"Oh?"
"Yes," Cap said, and fell silent for a moment. And the silence spun out agonizingly.
Cap had fallen into a study of his hands, which were neatly folded on the blotter in front of him. It was all Andy could do to keep from leaping across the desk and throttling him. Then Cap looked up.
"Dr. Pinchot is dead, Andy. He killed himself last night."
Andy's jaw dropped in unfeigned surprise. Alternating waves of relief and horror raced through him. And over it all, like a boiling sky over a confused sea, was the realization that this changed everything.
But how? How?
Cap was watching him. He suspects something. But are his suspicions serious or only a part of his job?
100 questions. He needed time to think, and he had no time. He would have to do his thinking on his feet.
That surprises you? Cap asked.
He was my friend, Andy said simply, and had to close his mouth to keep from saying more. This man would listen to him patiently. He would pause long after Andy's every remark, as he was pausing now, to see if Andy would plunge on, the mouth outracing the mind. Standard interrogation technique. And there were man pits in these woods. Andy felt it strongly. It had been an echo, of course, an echo that had turned into a ricochet. He had pushed Pinchot and started a ricochet, and it had torn the man apart. And for all of that, Andy could not find it in his heart to be sorry. There was horror, and there was a caveman who capered and rejoiced.
Are you sure it was... I mean, sometimes an accident can look like...
I'm afraid it was no accident.
He left a note?
Naming me? He dressed up in his wife's underwear, went out into the kitchen, started up the garbage disposal, and stuck his arm into it.
Oh, my God.
Andy sat down heavily. If there hadn't been a chair handy, he would have sat on the floor. All the strength had left his legs. He stared at Cap Hollister with sick horror.
You didn't have anything to do with that, did you, Andy?
Cap asked.
You didn't maybe push him into it?
No, Andy said. Even if I could still do it, why would I do a thing like that?
Maybe because he wanted to send you to the Hawaiians, Cap said. Maybe you didn't want to go to Maui because your daughter's here. Maybe you've been fooling us all along, Andy.
And although this Cap Hollister was crawling around on top of the truth, Andy felt a small loosening in his chest. If Cap really thought he had pushed Pinchot into doing that, this interview wouldn't be going on between just the two of them. No, it was just doing things by the book, that was all. They probably had all they needed to justify suicide in Pinchot's own file without looking for arcane methods of murder. Didn't they say the psychiatrists had the highest suicide rate of any profession?
No, that's not true at all, Andy said.
He sounded afraid, confused, close to blubbering.
I wanted to go to Hawaii. I told him that. I think that's why he wanted to make more tests, because I wanted to go. I don't think he liked me in some ways. But I sure didn't have anything to do with what happened to him.
Cap looked at him thoughtfully. Their eyes met for a moment, and then Andy dropped his gaze.
Well, I believe you, Andy, Cap said. Herm Pinchot had been under a lot of pressure lately. It's a part of this life we live, I suppose. Regrettable. Add this secret transvestism on top of that, and, well, it's going to be hard on his wife. Very hard. But we take care of our own, Andy.
Andy could feel the man's eyes boring into him.
Yes, we always take care of our own. That's the most important thing.
Sure, Andy said dully. There was a lengthening moment of silence. After a little bit, Andy looked up, expecting to see Cap looking at him. But Cap was staring out at the back lawn and the alders, and his face looked saggy and confused and old. The face of a man who has been seduced into thinking of other, perhaps happier times. He saw Andy looking at him, and a small wrinkle of disgust passed over his face and was gone. Sudden sour hate flared inside Andy. Why shouldn't this Hollister look disgusted? He saw a fat drug addict sitting in front of him. Or that was what he thought he saw. But who gave the orders? And what are you going to do to my daughter, you old monster?
Well, Cap said, I'm happy to tell you that you'll be going to Maui anyway. Andy, it's an ill wind that doesn't blow somebody good or something like that, hmm? I've started the paperwork already.
But, listen, you don't really think I had anything to do with what happened to Dr. Pinchot, do you?
No, of course not.
That small and involuntary ripple of disgust again.
And this time Andy felt the sick satisfaction that he imagined a black guy who has successfully tommed an unpleasant white man must feel. But over this was the alarm brought on by that phrase, "I've started the paperwork already." Well, that's good. Poor Dr. Pinchot. He looked downcast for only a token instant and then said eagerly, "When am I going?" "As soon as possible. By the end of next week at the latest." 9 days at the outside. It was like a battering ram in his stomach. "I've enjoyed our talk, Andy. I'm sorry we had to meet under such sad and unpleasant circumstances." He was reaching for the intercom switch, and Andy suddenly realized he couldn't let him do that. There was nothing he could do in his apartment with its cameras and listening devices. But if this guy really was the big cheese, this office would be as dead as a doornail. He would have the place washed regularly for bugs. Of course, he might have his own listening devices, but... "Put your hand down," Andy said, and pushed. Cap hesitated. His hand drew back and joined its mate on the blotter. He glanced out at the back lawn with that drifting, remembering expression on his face. "Do you tape meetings in here?"
"No,"
Cap said evenly. "For a long time I had a voice-activated Ewer 5000, like the one that got Nixon in trouble. But I had it taken out 14 weeks ago."
"Why?"
"Because it looked like I was going to lose my job."
"Why did you think you were going to lose your job?"
Very rapidly, in a kind of litany, Cap said, "No production, no production, no production. Funds must be justified with results. Replace the man at the top. No tapes, no scandal."
Andy tried to think it through. Was this taking him in a direction he wanted to go? He couldn't tell, and time was short. He felt like the stupidest, slowest kid at the Easter egg hunt. He decided he would go a bit further down this trail.
"Why weren't you producing?"
"No mental domination ability left in McGee. Permanently tipped over. Everyone in agreement on that. The girl wouldn't light fires. Said she wouldn't no matter what. People saying I was fixated on lot 6. Shot my bolt."
He grinned.
"Now it's okay. Even Rainbird says so."
Andy renewed the push, and a small pulse of pain began to meet in his forehead.
"Why is it okay?"
"3 tests so far. Hochstetter's ecstatic. Yesterday she flamed a piece of sheet steel. Spot temp over 20,000 degrees for 4 seconds, Hochstetter says."
Shock made the headache worse, made it harder to get a handle on his whirling thoughts. Charlie was lighting fires? What had they done to her? What in the name of God?
He opened his mouth to ask, and the intercom buzzed, jolting him into pushing much harder than he had to. For a moment he gave Cap almost everything there was. Cap shuddered all over as if he had been whipped with an electric cattle prod. He made a low, gagging sound, and his ruddy face lost most of its color. Andy's headache took a quantum leap, and he cautioned himself uselessly to take it easy. Having a stroke in this man's office wouldn't help Charlie.
"Don't do that," Cap whined. "Hurts."
"Tell them no calls for the next 10 minutes, Andy said. Somewhere the black horse was kicking at its stable door, wanting to get out, wanting to run free. He could feel oily sweat running down his cheeks. The intercom buzzed again. Cap leaned forward and pushed the toggle switch down. His face had aged 15 years.
"Cap, Senator Thompson's aide is here with those figures you asked for on Project Leap."
"No calls for the next 10 minutes, Cap said and clicked off. Andy sat drenched in sweat. Would that hold them? Or would they smell a rat? It didn't matter. As Willie Loman had been so wont to cry, the woods were burning. Christ, what was he thinking of Willie Loman for? He was going crazy. The black horse would be out soon, and he could ride there. He almost giggled.
"Charlie's been lighting fires?"
"Yes."
"How did you get her to do that?"
"Carrot and stick. Rainbird's idea. She got to take walks outside for the first 2. Now she gets to ride the horse. Rainbird thinks that will hold her for the next couple of weeks."
And he repeated, "Hochstetter's ecstatic."
"Who is this Rainbird?" Andy asked, totally unaware that he had just asked the jackpot question. Cap talked in short bursts for the next 5 minutes.
He told Andy that Rainbird was a shop hitter who had been horribly wounded in Vietnam, had lost an eye there. The one-eyed pirate in my dream, Andy thought numbly. He told Andy that it was Rainbird who had been in charge of the shop operation that had finally netted Andy and Charlie at Tashmore Pond. He told him about the blackout and Rainbird's inspired first step on the road to getting Charlie to start lighting fires under test conditions. Finally, he told Andy that Rainbird's personal interest in all this was Charlie's life when the string of deception had finally run itself out. He spoke of these matters in a voice that was emotionless, yet somehow urgent. Then he fell silent. Andy listened in growing fury and horror. He was trembling all over when Cap's recitation had concluded. Charlie, he thought. Oh, Charlie, Charlie. His 10 minutes were almost up, and there was still so much he needed to know. The two of them sat silent for perhaps 40 seconds. An observer might have decided they were companionable older friends who no longer needed to speak to communicate. Andy's mind raced. Captain Hollister, he said. Yes? When is Pinchett's funeral?
The day after tomorrow, Cap said calmly.
We're going. You and I. You understand?
Yes, I understand.
We're going to Pinchett's funeral. I asked to go. I broke down and cried when I heard he was dead.
Yes, you broke down and cried.
I was very upset.
Yes, you were.
We're going to go in your private car, just the two of us. There can be shop people in cars ahead and behind us. Motorcycles on either side, if that's standard operating procedure. But we're going alone. Do you understand?
Oh, yes. That's perfectly clear. Just the two of us.
And we're going to have a good talk. Do you also understand that?
Yes, a good talk.
Is your car bugged?
Not at all.
Andy began to push again, a series of light taps. Each time he pushed, Cap flinched a little, and Andy knew there was an excellent chance that he might be starting an echo in there, but it had to be done. We're going to talk about where Charlie is being kept. We're going to talk about ways of throwing this whole place into confusion without locking all the doors the way the power blackout did. And we're going to talk about ways that Charlie and I can get out of here. Do you understand?
You're not supposed to escape, Cap said in a hateful, childish voice. That's not in the scenario.
It is now, Andy said, and pushed again.
Ow!
Cap whined. Do you understand that?
Yes, I understand. Don't do that anymore. It hurts.
This Hockstetter, will he question my going to the funeral?
No, Hockstetter is all wrapped up in the little girl. He thinks of little else these days.
Good. It wasn't good at all. It was desperation. Last thing, Captain Hollister. You're going to forget that we had this little talk.
Yes, I'm going to forget all about it.
The black horse was loose. It was starting its run.
Take me out of here, Andy thought dimly. Take me out of here. The horse is loose and the woods are burning.
The headache came in a sickish cycle of thudding pain. Everything I've told you will occur naturally to you as your own idea.
Yes.
Andy looked at Cap's desk and saw a box of Kleenex there. He took one of them and began dabbing at his eyes with it. He was not crying, but the headache had caused his eyes to water. And that was just as good. I'm ready to go now, he said to Cap. He let go. Cap looked out at the alders again, thoughtfully blank. Little by little, animation came back into his face, and he turned toward Andy, who was wiping at his eyes a bit and sniffing. There was no need to overact.
How are you feeling now, Andy?
A little better, Andy said. But, you know, to hear it like that...
Yes, you were very upset, Cap said. Would you like to have a coffee or something?
No, thanks. I'd like to go back to my apartment, please.
Of course. I'll see you out.
Thank you. 22. The two men who had seen him up to the office looked at Andy with doubtful suspicion. The Kleenex, the red and watering eyes, the paternal arm that Cap had put around his shoulders.
Much the same expression came into the eyes of Cap's secretary.
"He broke down and cried when he heard Pinchot was dead," Cap said quietly. "He was very upset. I believe I'll see if I can arrange for him to attend Herman's funeral with me. Would you like to do that, Andy?"
"Yes," Andy said.
"Yes, please. If it can be arranged."
Poor Dr. Pinchot. And suddenly he burst into real tears. The two men led him past Senator Thompson's bewildered, embarrassed aide, who had several blue-bound folders in his hands. They took Andy out, still weeping, each with a hand clasped lightly at his elbow. Each of them wore an expression of disgust that was very similar to Cap's. Disgust for this fat drug addict who had totally lost control of his emotions and any sense of perspective, and gushed tears for the man who had been his captor. Andy's tears were real, but it was Charlie he wept for. 23. John always rode with her, but in her dreams Charlie rode alone. The head groom, Peter Drabble, had fitted her out with a small, neat English saddle, but in her dreams she rode bareback. She and John rode on the bridle paths that wove their way across the shop grounds, moving in and out of the toy forest of sugar pines and skirting the duck pond, never doing more than an easy canter. But in her dreams, she and Necromancer galloped together, faster and faster, through a real forest. They plunged at speed down a wild trail, and the light was green through the interlaced branches overhead, and her hair streamed out behind her. She could feel the ripple of Necromancer's muscles under his silky hide, and she rode with her hands twisted in his mane and whispered in his ear that she wanted to go faster, faster, faster. Necromancer responded. His hooves were thunder. The path through these tangled green woods was a tunnel, and from somewhere behind her there came a faint crackling and... "The woods are burning." A whiff of smoke. It was a fire she had started. But there was no guilt, only exhilaration. They could outrace it. Necromancer could go anywhere, do anything. They would escape the forest tunnel. She could sense brightness ahead. Faster, faster.